The title for this section is on career development. First, I'd like to express appreciation for your attentive ears. I've never done this sort of thing before, where the bulk of all these presentations have basically been focused on my own personal experiences in this country and with the educational system and with people who have made significant contributions to my life. And the piece on career development has been quite a powerful one, because these years that cover that would be what I would call more recent years now. Everything that I've talked about for the past 3 days have in effect led to this particular stage in my life, and I'm very happy to share that with you. I do want to caution you. I will be saying some things about the church that may be that you may not like to hear, and you may find the need to be defensive about it. And I'm encouraging you not to have to worry about being defensive about it, simply because, as I've indicated a couple of times in previous sessions, these are really very, very personal, specific experiences relative to myself, and are not intended to make generalizations across theory that may be unproven scientifically across a general population or anything like that. Nevertheless, they are personal experiences, and these are personal values that have shaped myself and have offered a perspective that have shaped my career development. So I just wanted to caution you by saying those kinds of remarks. Very interesting ones. I think for this purpose today, I will start at seminary. I indicated to the group yesterday that I've gone through 3 seminaries. I'm quite an expert on them. In the early years when I made the decision then to serve my Lord and Savior Jesus Christ in the ministry, feeling the call to serve in that capacity, as a person in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, we really had no options then other than going to the seminary that was at Springfield, Illinois. Some of you may know about the farm system that the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod has, where you go through the Concordia prep schools and their high schools and their junior colleges, and then eventually go to St. Louis, having already had several years of Greek, German, church history, and I suspect then they picked up Hebrew as a language in their first year at seminary there. But for people who do not have that background, such as I, they had an alternative seminary, and Springfield for me was quite a shock. And it was a shock in terms of the educational philosophy and approach and style that they used. It was mostly memory work. And I remember, you know, coming out of Valparaiso, that was a real eye-opening. Valparaiso had saved me educationally. I had done very well there and built a lot of self-confidence and was really feeling good about myself as a student with a possible career ahead of me. Going to Springfield was quite traumatic, because the I remember debating and arguing with some of the professors, why do you teach the course this way, or why are tests given in this way? In the very first course we had in Christian dogmatics, for a final examination, they will give you in advance 300 questions along with their answers. And they told you to memorize them all, and on the day when you walk in for your final exam, you would get 50 questions. And if you've done your homework, in other words, if you've memorized everything, then you'd have the answers for those 50 questions that we're going to give you. Well, that was basically the predominant teaching style at Concordia. I died. I just dive with that kind of approach. I refused to memorize anything. And the closest analogy I could give you, and which I experienced, was that it reminded me of Chinese school when I was a kid. And in Chinese school, when we did not recite our lessons well, we were whipped with a nice bamboo stick across our palms and the fleshy portions. We were disciplined that way every Friday. And I never learned the Chinese, I never was a Chinese student because of it. And this was Concordia after Valpo. I said, no, you know, I'll have none of it. And so that was a traumatic year for me. And that was the year then when I had to do some reflections on where to go. Some of you who may be familiar with the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod may understand what I'm saying, because at that point in time, when you choose to leave Missouri, there is nowhere to go. It's comparable to someone who was reared in the Roman Catholic Church now, and who all of a sudden decide, you know, they no longer want to be a Catholic. The options and alternatives were very few. And fortunately, in my case, I had been exposed to Sunday school teachers, choir directors, and youth directors from the Biblical Seminary in New York City, who were assigned to our congregation as an intern experience. So I knew them, and when we were in high school, there were many, many occasions to go to that seminary. Annually, they would have a youth day, and so all these seminarians would bring the youth from their congregation to the seminary, and we would have a whole day of fellowship, which that was just wonderful. And I remember I liked it so much. When I was in high school, I even signed up for one of their extension courses in study of the Gospel of Luke. So I knew, the professor was Palmer. Didn't remember her. Margaret Wickstrom had also been a student there, so we have something in common there. And
is it denominational?
It was a non-denominational seminary. However, when I was there, Dr. Emily Werner was on faculty, and she's a Lutheran. And Dr. Mabel, what was her name?
Alida
Storsley was dean of women there. Most of the ALC people would remember Alida, and she was there as a Lutheran faculty member, and there was probably another one that I don't remember. It was an interdenominational faculty as well. So I transferred to the Biblical Seminary and had 2 years of a really wonderful, wonderful experience there, becoming a Hispanic congregation. There, it was an old German congregation, and it was a transition neighborhood, so that there were a lot of Jewish people and Puerto Ricans who began moving into that area. And I interned there under Pastor Charles Trexler. So when I found another Lutheran church home then, it was very clear to me that I needed to go to another seminary to meet ordination requirements in the United Lutheran Church of America. I made sure that I did not make the same mistake again with Lutheran seminaries. So I began collecting all the catalogs of all of our Lutheran seminaries. And by then, I had also appreciated the use of the seminary's library. And in fact, I should say something about the Biblical Seminary curriculum. They had no textbooks. Everything was library work. And every assignment we met only once a week with the professor. And so everything was library work. And when we met for a block of 2-3 hours at a time. So there was an enormous amount of library work. Because it was non-denominational, the institution encouraged the students to understand their own theology, to be prepared to defend your own faith in your dialogue with students from another background. And so there was a lot of respect for one another's differences, but you had better be prepared to know why you believe what you believe. So in that sense, the seminary was intellectually very stimulating, and there was a high degree of intellectual integrity in the approach that they used, and encouraged the use of library, and I just flourished that way, just loved it. And so one main criterion was I got to find a Lutheran seminary with the largest library, the best library. That was a very important criteria. Another criterion was that I was looking for a seminary that had a strong counseling program or pastoral or theology program, because through my experiences as an intern with the youth groups in our church, I enjoyed working with the youth. And in my assessment of that situation, the ones that I enjoyed most were the ones who went on to college. And so nestled in the back of my memory was the possibility of going into campus ministry, because the youth whom I enjoyed working with, who were most dynamic, who had the greatest leadership and greatest excitement and creativity, were the youth leaders of our church, and they all went on to college. So I wanted to place myself in a position where they would be, because I enjoyed working with that population. So those were variables that entered my mind. And so I wrote to the Lutheran seminaries, and I got a strong letter from Mount Airy that says, "What are you doing at the Biblical Seminary? If you want to be ordained in the Lutheran Church, you come right down to Philadelphia now, you know." And I read that letter, showed it to Mabel, and I said, "No way, this sounds too much like Springfield, Illinois." You know? So the registrar at Gettysburg, Reginald Dietz, God bless his soul, he wrote me a letter and says, "I'm so happy to hear that you are planning to enter the ministry and wish you God's richest blessings. And when you are ready to make your transfer, we will be happy to receive you." Hey, you know, when you get a letter like that, you know, the PR that Reggie Dietz performed for that seminary was wonderful. So we went to Gettysburg and had one wonderful year there. The 2 years at Biblical Seminary and one at Gettysburg were idyllic years. They were years I loved everything we did. They were just spiritually filled, wonderful years, intellectually sound, stimulating, academically rich, and did very well in them. Did very well at the seminaries, and in retrospect, they were very naive years. I mean, we were very idealistic. We were going to serve the Lord, you know, and nothing else mattered, you know. We were, and if the bishop would just, you know, we would go wherever the bishop wanted us to go, like in the Augustana tradition, you know. So then what happened when we left Gettysburg, the bishop, and I have to give him a lot of credit, his name is Alfred Beck from the New York New England Synod. Al Beck had tried his best. I think he had, I would say, forcefulness of character and integrity. And this was back in 1959, before the Civil Rights Movement. And there were not many, many Asian or black pastors in the Lutheran Church then. In fact, in my graduating class, there was H. Matsushita, whom some of you may know from DMNA days in the LCA, who was a classmate, and Rudy Featherstone, who was a black pastor, and myself. And the bishop told the call committee at Christ Lutheran Church in Germantown, New York, that his nominee for pastor there was, his number one nominee was Jim Moy, his number two nominee was Jim Moy, his number three nominee is Jim Moy, and those are the only names you're going to get. And, you know, that system is very, very good. And here, from this perspective, I speak as a minority person from that respect, and I think some of our female pastors can also appreciate that approach. So we went to Germantown, a population 2,500, Columbia County, which was a depressed area. And the congregation, although had the mailing address as Germantown, was really located in Vilmont with a population that was even smaller. And in retrospect, I must say that those 3 years were the most powerful teaching, learning experiences for me, and also the most traumatic and most anxiety-filled ones. They were all real experiences that people will find in any congregation. And I had all my sharp edges rounded off. All my idealism had just came right down, you know, to the real world where things are. I think I might have indicated the other day that the treasurer of my congregation said things to me about our congregation's budget and stewardship program. He said things to me that my father had said to me years ago when I was in high school when I wanted to go into the ministry. My father would used to say, you know, he's not a Christian. And he was really speaking against my going into the ministry, and he would say such things like, who is your God? Who feeds you? Who gives you bread? Who gives you rice? You know, I do. What kind of God is it that you, you know? And he would say things like that. And my treasurer would say, Pastor, what do you expect? You know, you can't squeeze blood from a rock, you know, when you talk about budgets. And I had gotten the sense that in a rural, depressed economy in the community that we lived in, people did not have a very, very high sense of expectation of themselves as Christians in that community. It was very, very depressing. And I spent 3 years ministering in that situation. And, you know, you can't pull a boy out of New York City and stick him in Vilmont, Germantown, a rural community, and expect that that person would thrive. I did not thrive, but I did. What I did was read a lot. As one of the blessings of a rural parish where not much happens. Not much happened at all. They didn't even miss me when I would. Well, here's what happened. I told the bishop, I said, you know what? I'm reading more books than any of the pastors in our district. And that's not right. The other pastors are just dying intellectually. Here I'm reading all this stuff, you know. I have lots of time to read, you know. And he says, Jim, he says, are you interested in the campus pastorate? I said, yes. Well, why don't you consider going on to graduate school? Because if you are planning to be a campus pastor, it would be good to have a graduate degree. I said, fine. In fact, Jim, there is monies available with a Trexler Fellowship in the Synod. And Sam Trexler, who was the first Synod's bishop, had endowed this fund. He was a very, very, from a very, very wealthy family. So they had this money available. And it was really money set aside for pastors who have been in the parish for about 5 years or more. And this money was available to help them broaden their experiences and get more education. And my pastor, Charles Trexler, was chairman of that committee. So I said, okay, I will apply for it. And I did. And the bishop and I went to the church council and asked if I could have permission to do some part-time studies, graduate work. And they, sure, why not? And so for about a year and a half, I completed a master's degree in guidance and counseling in higher education at Teachers College at Columbia. And what I meant by saying that they didn't miss me was that there would be occasions when, you know, when you're preparing to study for final exams and I'm cooped up in my library reading for 2-3 days in a row, they don't really miss you. One thing I learned, the most important thing at that time was you have to be available to them when parishioners, when there are crises in the family. And so there were a few occasions, not many, but few, when I would be at Columbia and I would call home to check, well, what's happening? And someone's, Rose Ham's husband died, you know, and I would just forget about the classes. I'd come right back and call on Rose and minister to that family. It was a period in my life when I had to do a lot of rethinking about the ministry and whether or not I was suited for the parish. I need to say that I did very well in that congregation. It was a small congregation, and they were rural farmers, and I learned a number of things. Rural people are not very verbal. They are hands-on people, but they don't, they're not intellectual. And here I was offering Bible study classes and get one person, you know, because they don't talk. They work with their hands. If you have a church supper, everyone's out. Everyone's out working. Or if you want to have the church painted, which is what we did, everyone come out and do that. But when it comes to Bible study and when it comes to discussions on various issues like that, you just can't drag these farmers out. In the 3 years when I was there, I had 60 funerals. You divide that over one, you know, over 3 years, there's 20 funerals a year. I had only two baptisms. And so I began saying such things as, I wonder, is this what I can expect as a future in the church? There's a young pastor coming out. And I said, well, let me look at the yearbook, you know. And I looked at the yearbook and analyzed the budgets of all the congregations listed in the yearbook, and made the assumption that maybe 25% of the budget was devoted to the pastor's salary. I looked at the whole thing and I said, God, these guys don't make much money, you know? And there might be one or two. And I said, who are they, you know? And you know who they were, Pastor Lowy from Buffalo. You know, these were the princes of the church. You know, these were guys who are bishop runner-ups. Big churches, one big church in Albany, maybe a few in Syracuse, Rochester, and Buffalo, and maybe one or two in New York and a couple in Long Island. I looked at that and I said, who are the pastors? And I looked at that, and they're all men in their mid-50s. And I said to myself, I'm not going to wait till I'm in my mid-50s to serve these congregations. And I'd be darned if I'm going to sit in a small place and starve for 30 years with the hopes that maybe I get a call to one of these plums, you know. And of course, I share this with you, for lay people especially, because these are the kinds of things we think of. I don't know if the other pastors think this way or not, but this is what comes to my mind. And then I said, and you're an Asian too, you know. What's the chances really then of being called to these places? And it was then I came to the conclusion that I did not give up the hope and dream of serving the Lord in the church. But then I began saying, well, maybe it's not in the parish. And because, as all of us know these days, and I have a lot of suggestions for bishops as to how they should work the call process, but when you have a congregation's call committee that can decide on two or three candidates, the probabilities are highly unlikely that they will settle on the women or on a person over 55 or on a minority. It's just the facts of life in a white congregation. That's just the facts of life. And taking that reality into consideration, Tom Blevins always paired his nominees who were homogeneous. So that we always paired two female candidates, so that we knew that that was the choice they had available to them. If you gave them one male and one female, they picked the male all the time. Anyway, those were some learnings I had in my youth. And when I graduated from Columbia, this was back in 63, and higher education was bustling out all over. And I had maybe five or six job offers. And through advisors at Columbia and in conversation with the bishop, I decided to accept the job as Dean of Men, Assistant Dean of Students at McAllister College, St. Paul, Minnesota. And the logic there was, well, with some experience as a college administrator, if I wanted to go back into campus ministry, it would strengthen my applications. I will have experience in higher education, and I will be very, very knowledgeable about higher education. So we went to McAllister, and in the first year there, met Gordy Dahl, who is the Lutheran campus pastor on the University of Minnesota campus. And there were Lutheran students at McAllister and Hamlin, and they asked me if I would serve the Lutheran students there, and I agreed to do that. So I was able to link in campus ministry work with my other job at McAllister. We stayed at St. Paul for 3 years, and they were probably one of the richest years I've had, because it was another complete world. I mean, you know, you go into an intellectual academic world in higher education compared to Germantown, which is a rural place. It was like night and day as far as intellectual stimulation went. The experience I had at McAllister encouraged me to go on for a doctorate. And here probably is where I made the mistake, because I believed that message. Back in those days, this was still 63, 66, the president of the college indicated that they were hiring, they were only hiring PhDs, and that if anyone wanted a career in higher education, they need that union card. That's basic. So I began scrounging around for fellowships. Some of you from Minnesota might know of the Bush Foundation. And incidentally, I was one of the first Bush leaders. In 68, won a Bush Leadership Fellowship and went to Harvard. And it was at Harvard when I met J. Leslie Rollins, who was an associate dean in the Harvard Business School. The fellowship was a 2-year grant, and the second one involved an internship, so that J. Leslie Rollins said to me, I want you, Jim, to go on to Athens, Ohio to intern there, because there are marvelous things going on with that university. The president, who is Dr. Vernon Alden, had built a fantastic operation there, and it'd be good to go there and intern there to see how a good university is run. So I moved there in March of 67. And within a week, the school closed down for a non-academic employees union strike. And I called Mabel in Cambridge and says, guess what, you know, the school's closed. I interned in the Vice President's for Development office and was interested in analyzing the whole fund development processes of a university. I chose that field because one of the things I enjoyed immensely in my first call at Germantown was a stewardship, raising money. And it was a matter of bread and butter, because for a pastor, I knew that if the stewardship was bad, you don't get paid. And I loved that work. I loved it, raising money and being a stewardship program. And in fact, since then, I've served as stewardship chair for University Lutheran in Seattle. Just love raising money. I have very, very materialistic, vivid imagination. So I interned in the development office and learned a lot about how to raise funds for a state university and what the politics were. And it was while we were there then, I chose to stay, found a job there in the Residence Life program, managed a large complex of about 11 halls, housing about 4,000 students. And these were the years in 1967, 68, 69, 70. And these were the years when student demonstrations permeated all the campuses. These were the years with Kent State shootings. These were the years when I was trying to restore law and order on the campuses. And during all that time, all my time at McAllister as well as at Ohio University, I kept my eye, one eye open on the work that the chaplains were doing or that the campus pastors were doing, because there was a longing in my heart to find out if I ever made the right decision or not. I need to say that the university campus pastors on the Athens campus were their credibility was so high and enormous, and they were respected so much by the students that when all hell was breaking loose and there was no order or sanity on the campuses anymore, the campus pastors were the one who brought sanity and order to the campus. The students just did not trust the administration on anything, and they made the administration appear to look like fools so often. And I was telling him that I thought that my ministry in working within the structures of the institution was more effective from the way I saw things. And he was telling me, no, a ministry outside the structures of the institution are more effective. And I was balancing and constantly weighing and evaluating the effectiveness of my work as over against the effectiveness of the campus pastor's work. And I need to say to Gil Doan today that he was right, because the campus pastors at Ohio University did a wonderful job. There were a transition that we made because when I finished the PhD, I had, so to speak, you know, arrived. You know, this was a goal that was set way back in 63. And Dr. John Bachman, from the president of Wartburg College, had called me and asked if I would be interested in the dean of students position at Wartburg. And I went to the campus and interviewed for several days. And I told him, I said, John, I'm too liberal for you Lutherans, you know. But I had gone through McAllister and a state school, you know, and I thought, God, I'm too liberal for the quiet, gentle Lutherans, you know. He says, no, Jim, you're just the person we're looking for. So we moved from Ohio, or actually, we had an interim. We moved from West Virginia to Waverly, Iowa, to Wartburg College. There was a period when we were in Athens when I did a lot of pulpit supplying in New Haven, West Virginia. And the bishop from Western Penn, West Virginia, called me one day and said, Jim, would you like to be a candidate there? And I said, well, I've just accepted a job at Ohio University. Oh, well, you know, he kind of regretted that. And we had some conversations, and I continued supplying that congregation. And that congregation had been turned down by five candidates. They just did not pay enough money. And so then, 3 years later, the bishop calls me again and says, will you still consider a call there? By then, I had completed all my coursework. So I said, yes, Dr. Hanke. So we moved to New Haven, West Virginia, while I was just reading, doing my chapter 3 for review of literature for my dissertation, and moved to West Virginia and had probably what I would call a saving, helpful experience at the congregation in West Virginia, because there was such a Mabel says to me, do you really want to go back into the parish ministry? You know, and I said, yes, I'm ready. I said, number one, I'm less idealistic now. I'm older, more mature, more battle-weary. Had many more skills in working with conflict situations and people. And I felt that I was better prepared to go back into the parish. And I did. And it was wonderful. It was really a wonderful experience. I don't want to dwell on that piece of it too much because there's some other material to cover. But I can say that the experience in West Virginia with Appalachian folk was just absolutely wonderful as an Asian. I was accepted fully. There were a lot of Asians in the area who were professional doctors there. And as a pastor in their midst, I was family. And most West Virginians will not accept outsiders. And it gave me a lot of insight in understanding mentality of Appalachia that was just very, very helpful. It was the kind of experience I think I would have stayed very happily in and stayed for a long while. But the school systems were horrible. And this was no place to raise our kids. The school systems, some of you following the debate between the creationists theories and the evolutionist theories will be where in West Virginia they were very, very strong in the creationist theories, and it was educationally, academically, a horrible place to raise children. But aside from that one aspect, in terms of educational philosophies, it was really a very accepting, warm environment. We moved to McAllister, we moved to Wartburg, and were there 5 years. And then there was a turning point. At that time then, when we moved to Iowa, my wife and I agreed that by the time our children became teenagers, we would want to find ourselves living in a cosmopolitan urban area. So that was kind of an unwritten acceptance and agreement between the two of us, and we moved to Waverly with that understanding. It was good timing because it just so happened that the college presidencies also changed right around that time. We moved to Seattle, Washington, or rather, I need to say that when we were job hunting, to look for jobs in urban environments, Mabel found a job in Seattle. And I said to her, well, go and take it. And you tell me if you like the place and if that's the place where we should come or not. And if it is, then I'll resign and we'll sell the house and move. No sense in having her take the kids with her because it may not work out. So she rented an apartment in the university district, came out here by herself, and for about a 6-month period, I went through one of the worst depressions that I've ever encountered in all of my experiences. Given that whole, you know, given all the traumas, that was the worst depression I've ever experienced. And I was so fortunate to be at Wartburg, where I had so many colleagues who were in the ministry, who were Bill Freeling, who is chairman of the psychology department one time at Wartburg, listening ears, the chairman of the social work department, they listened to me. And I wrote long letters to Mabel, 60-page letters, you know, long letters. Yeah, I'm a real good diary writer, you know. By then, you know, my diary techniques. Shared all my feelings with her. Couldn't understand why I was so depressed until I began talking it out, and writing. And I could summarize very quickly. I told Mabel, you know how I feel? I said, I feel as if by going to Seattle, I will have died. Here I am, 40 years old. And, you know, in this culture and in this society, I suppose in any industrialized culture and society, a man at 40 should be at the peak of his performing powers, you know. And here I am going to give up a job that had, you know, all the status, symbols, powers, and prestige, the being important and being known, you know, I'm going to give all of that up to go to a place where no one will know me. I feel as if I will have died. And when that awareness came to the surface, then I felt comfortable to resign, which I did. I resigned. Mabel bought a house in Seattle. I sold the house in Iowa. We moved the family out there in the winter. We thought that would be a great adventure. And we thought, well, why not? You know, we said when we were in graduate school that whoever gets the job first will follow it. We said that rationally, intellectually. We're both on PhD programs there, and we're both looking for jobs at the same time. I happened to find a job at Wartburg first, and she followed me. So now it was my turn to follow her. That's logical, isn't it? Well, I tell you, I was so depressed, unemployed for 11 months, and it was a role reversal that the women love. I tell the story, the women love it. The men don't understand it, you know? In the mornings, she would go to work, kids would go to school, and I'd vacuum the house. Well, how many times can you vacuum a house? Culturally speaking, I knew the neighbor next door, this young woman next door was home, and so were the next door and the next door and the next door. All the women on the block, well, they were all home. Dare I go and have coffee with them? Like all the other women? I mean, if you want to do a role reversal, this is it, you know. No, I felt isolated and lonely, terribly depressed, and feeling as if, God, you know, all these years of education is just being shot and thrown out the window now, you know. I remember saying to myself, when I go to Seattle, I could either, well, one of the first things I want to do is call on the bishop. Let him know I'm available. Second thing I could do, I could be a counselor. Third thing I could do is maybe find another management job in one of the universities in Seattle. And in 1975, 76, there ain't no jobs at all to be found in those fields. And I met Bishop Fieldman. Who are you, young man? You know, who are you, you know? I learned many years later that bishops don't like that. They don't like a pastor to show up unannounced in his territory. And here I am, give me a call, you know. The bishops don't like that. So I felt so depressed in job search. As a counselor, I knew enough that I better go and seek help. So I went through the Yellow Pages, and there was this wonderful advertisement called the Individual Development Center. And I called them and said, I need to talk to a counselor. And the woman was trying to put me off, kept on trying to put me off. But I kept on insisting that I see someone right away. And they finally got a hold of Aline Morris. People know Aline Morris? Mm-hmm. Some do. She didn't know me. I didn't know her from Adam. And I walked in to the agency and filled out my intake sheet. We went into her office. She looked at my intake sheet. And the first thing she said to me was, my husband's a Lutheran pastor. You know? And it was so good to hear her say that. And it was so good to just visit with her. And when I told her my story, she says, Jim, you're just 5 years ahead of your time. And I said to myself, now that was a poor counseling technique. That offered me no consolation to be 5 years ahead of time, you know. But she became my first friend in Seattle. And I mentioned that at my installation when I joined the Synod staff many years later. Because I think meeting her, she became my first friend, because, I mean, all of Seattle could care less about Jim Moy, but she was my friend, immensely helpful, and she helped me find a position at the Seattle Opportunities Industrialization Center. And most blacks will know what that organization is. It's the organization founded by Leon Sullivan for vocational skill training for disadvantaged, hardcore, unemployed blacks in this country. And I went there to interview for a job as a psychometrician. Walked in to meet Ike Turner, and he says, can you write? I said, oh, yes, I can write, you know. People, remember my story from 2 days ago? Can I write, you know? I know how to use my semicolons, you know. And so I was hired as the institution's writer. I was a proposal writer, program development specialist. I wrote proposals for them 8 hours a day for almost a whole year. And it was a wonderful introduction to that whole field of the CETA program. And the Seattle organization was one of the best ones in the country. So we were very proud of what they were able to do there. Gave me a lot of insight on what one needs to do in this country to really adequately serve hardcore unemployed blacks or other minorities who need a lot of simple basic things which we in the middle class assume. They just need to know how, for instance, to dress. They need to know how to appear for a job interview. They need to know how to manage their money after they get it. They need to know how to take care of their kids and how to spend their money. You know, there's just so many basic things. Anyway, when I was at OIC, I met a number of really interesting people and eventually wound up with Lutheran Community Services in Pierce County. I did some planning workshops for the Rainier District of the West Tacoma Conference of the ALC, and was introduced to Pastor Dick Fagey. I think he was one of the first pastors I met in Tacoma. And gradually, a little at a time, began developing friends in the Lutheran community, and finally became executive director at Lutheran Community Services, and was there for about 6-7 years. And then when Tom Blevins was elected bishop, there were a lot of ALC pastor friends of mine who said, Jim, you should really apply for that job. We need a friend in the LCA who really know us ALC folk, you know. And I did. I applied for that position and then became assistant to Tom Blevins and was there until the merger of the church. I share the story with you because there were a number of major key turning points in my experience that I thought would warrant dialogue here this evening. And we have about, 20 minutes yet?
No.
No? 10 minutes? What time do we need to end about? 7:50?
55.
Yeah, about 10 minutes. So I'll be happy to respond to any questions you all may have.
You want to say anything about your position?
Now?
I'd like to hear what you have to say about it.
Oh, no, not really now. No. I think the career appears very helter-skelter for some people who might have been in one job for 30 years. They can't believe all the moves we've made. In retrospect, I'm not sure if that doctorate was really that helpful or not, professionally. There were many times when Mabel and I said to ourselves, why are we doing this? Why are we doing this, you know? Especially when you're really down right near the end, when you have to get that dissertation in. Hey, I don't need to do that dissertation. It will not add one iota to my knowledge, you know? Why do I need to finish that for, you know? Right, Ken? So there were many, many occasions, and we must be masochists, you know? And I think one event that happened when both Mabel and I were graduated, by then, when we graduated, Mabel's mother gave each one of us a gold coin that she had saved over all the 40, 50 years of her life in the USA as a present to us. To the mother, coming here as an immigrant, not knowing English at all, to see her daughter go that far in education. The Chinese really value education, and so that was really, really history as far as that clan goes. Yeah, the new position I was director for a program for social ministry development in the ELCA. And beginning in September, I will be director for inclusiveness leadership development. And the job that I will have will focus on strengthening the whole recruitment process for minority candidates for ministry, both in the Associates for Ministry program as well as for ordained ministry. And that will entail identifying mentors, pastors, leaders in the church who can be good role models, and it will be identifying prospects in the high schools or in the colleges and in the campus, university campuses, and with the youth conventions. It will involve identifying them and also giving the challenge to the young about the real challenges and the real what I consider the great opportunities for bringing the gospel of Jesus Christ to everyone in the work of the church. And so that would be one of my major responsibilities. I will work with the seminaries to assist in their strengthening their recruitment programs in this area.
That's new, isn't it?
It's a new position, and because of my academic background, the executive director has asked me to also then oversee the psychological testing program for candidates in ministry as well, and to develop that whole system. It will be a new position, so it'll be something that I will find I will enjoy very much. Yeah. Any questions about any of the comments I might have made? Yes, sir.
You touched briefly at the beginning on a given, that is the very powerful influence of the Scandinavian, Germanic, cultural, ethnic background in Lutheranism in this country, and the fact that that overlaid with a lot of other isms that exist in white middle-class America make it very difficult for local congregations to accept as pastors, particularly senior pastors, people of color or women, or in the stronger churches or larger churches, I should say, people who are older than 55. What's your prognosis about how we're going to deal with those realities in local congregations and try to help them come to terms with calling people who don't fit the mold?
I have seen in my own personal experience the value in having a strong bishop who would be an advocate. And I think that's necessary. That may be perhaps where the whole thing can begin to introduce change. When I went to Germantown, there were families who chose no longer to come to church, not while I was there. The most amazing thing, of course, you discover in a rural congregation is that everyone is related to everyone in the whole county. And I remember there were some of my members in my congregation that would tell me who these families were, because these are uncles and aunts of their own, you know. Please call on Eldridge Lasher, will you, Pastor? He's one of those guys who chose not to come, you know. So I tell my friends, you know what I did? I call the hell out of him. I call him all the time. Make him feel guilty like anything, but I called him, and I was so nice to him. Well, Eldridge is one of these farmers who don't talk, so you talk to the spouse, but they put up with you. And I've said this to a number of our black clergy. You call them because you're still the pastor. Let them throw you out. But you call them. That's what I did. And, of course, Eldridge never dared throw me out. We just had a good time talking. Of course, you know, there were so many things I did that was helpful in breaking down these stereotypes, and you know, in terms of communication and racial understanding. it really wore me out. You'd get tired of doing it all the time, but in Germantown, that's what I had to do. I go there and make them teach me how to butcher a hog. I go there and teach and learn how to tree farm. And I'd go there and they'd help me, and I'd help them sort pears and apples. And we'd go there and wives would be glad to teach me how to bake pie, cinnamon rolls, you know. Because you learn right away that those are their loves. So I began relating to them in that way. It was fortunate that I loved and enjoyed all of that. So, yes, sir.
I can relate to this question if you want, Jim.
Yeah.
I happen to be 60, and I told my bishop I wanted to move, and he said, okay, I'll write some letters for you. And he says, you can stay here, and he's still pleading. And one of the letters went up to another senate, and the guy, I'm 60. I turned down one call, and he badgered me about that one. Well, I thought maybe he'd forget me for a while. That sucker's back on the phone just before I came to hold and say, Kolsky, you got to come where I want you to go. And when I get home, I have a fear that he has already told them, you're going to get Kolsky, Kolsky, Kolsky. The strange phenomenon of this whole thing is that it's two parishes that I was the neighboring pastor.
Oh.
And the reason they want me to go back up there, he said, Kolsky, when are you going to retire? And I've been thinking about 62. Well, forget that now. He said, will you stay there 5 years for me? He said, well, you're 65, I'll take you out for a party. Just stay 5 years.
Yeah.
And don't rock the boat. He says, go up there and just what you're saying. He says, go sit on the boat with them. And he says, if they want to tell you how to fix Christmas trees, because that's tree farm country, he said, you better learn and learn how which end of the cow goes in first.
That's right.
And he said, learn to stand on a manure pile.
That's right. I go,
this is cow country.
Yeah, I went and helped deliver the calf. New York City for you.
What I'm saying is I think it depends upon the bishop, because that letter went to six different bishops, and I got four of the most beautiful baloney letters you ever want to read about the how and the why for.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think it's the bishop is the key to the whole thing.
I really think it is. Now, so that's one ingredient in the mix. And I'm terribly aware that these bishops were elected, and so that it is a political position and that there are risks involved, but I think the risks are worth it for the sake of the church. From the candidate's perspective, especially from a minority candidate, there are a number of variables that are very complex. In my case, for instance, as an American-born person, having been trained, reared, and educated in this country now, I knew, for instance, when I graduated from seminary, that I was a pretty good student by then. Oh, I could read my New Testament in Greek backwards and forwards. I knew that. And when I entered the parish and watched the performance of the other pastors who were older there, I knew that I knew more than they. I think that's all the young seminaries. They all come out so cocky, you know, they all know that. So you know, it's measuring where that person is going to go now. Where can the church take full advantage and use those gifts that it has trained and prepared, those servants, you know. And I was not willing to be stereotyped into serving a Chinese congregation for a number of reasons. And everyone in the Chinese community, or even in the Japanese community, can tell you that, you know. It's very hard because I cannot read or write Chinese. You know, I don't have any self-confidence there. So when you begin talking about preaching and teaching and calling, I'm an illiterate as far as Chinese goes. I have bread and butter Chinese, can get along, and the vocabulary basically is the same vocabulary I acquired when I was 8, 10, 12 years old. So there are many, many reasons that militates against going into serving a strictly first-generation congregation. I have learned, however, just in a conversation just within 2 weeks ago from Bill Wong, Pastor Wong is the Director for Asian Ministries in the Commission for Multicultural Ministries. And in his contacts in the Chicago area, he's been told that there is a great need for Chinese pastors with English now to serve the second and third generation. And he's, in fact, Bill's been told, you can write your own ticket now. So maybe the market has changed. Who knows? Yes, sir.
Would you have any idea how many minority pastors we have in the church today?
No, I don't have that statistic, but I'm sure we can get that. There are, we have, you know, in the Multicultural Commission, that organization has access to all that information. And I don't know, is Paul Nakamura here? Is Paul around? He might know, because he was president of the Asian Caucus. Paul, how many Asian pastors do we have on the continent in America? How many Asian pastors do we have?
Asian pastors?
Yeah.
I think about 40.
Of those 40, how many are American-born? And of those 40, how many are over 60 years old? Yeah, my memory tells me that there is going to be a great need because of so many being in their 60s. Well, I thank you for your patience bearing with me. Thank you.